there a motion to approve the agenda?
I motion to approve.
Second.
Is there a motion to approve the meeting from last?
I motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
At this moment, we'll take comments from the audience that may be made on items not listed on the agenda that are of public interest and within the subject matter jurisdiction of the district. The committee has a policy of limiting speakers to not more than 3 minutes. The committee cannot take action on items not listed on the agenda. Public input may be offered on the agenda item when it comes up for discussion. Is there any public comments at this time? So we'll move on to new business. Presentation?
Oh, that's a foundation.
So we'll move on to old business. Funding requests.
It's just an update on the funding requests that have come in to date with LOIs. Those that are stage two applications, where I've highlighted either in dark blue or bold red the updates on different organizations. Okay. If you have any questions, excuse me.
I have more of a comment about the Loma Linda University Children's Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Last time we were here, I mentioned that I live in the neighborhood of the clinic and I also don't have children, so that might be a reason why. But any information locally about Loma Linda Clinic? In addition to waiting for the following information, clinic's operating finances, future projections of the clinic, assumption of the clinic's sustainability, it'll be very hard for me to approve anything or to recommend that the clinic approves anything if I don't see a communications plan for the local sort of community around that health center. It's been around for a couple years. Their numbers are, like their deficit is very deep. I know of one of the health centers, it took 4 years. One of my experiences, 4 years for health center to like also get up to par with their deficiency of patient inflow, but there was a very strong communication program with promotoras, Spanish language radio ads, billboards, all sorts of like really deep intentional community outreach. So it'll be very difficult for me to approve such a large grant with that kind of a deficit without some kind of knowledge of what they are doing for outreach.
All right.
And I just have a comment. I recently heard that the pediatric clinic in Loma Linda has gastroenterologists now.
Oh, okay.
So now the patients can. They don't have to try to.
What has been our history in terms of funding programs like this in the past? I know that we have a relationship with Borrego Health. Have they come to us in the past with a deficit and requested funding?
No.
And Loma Linda seems to be, I don't know, I guess that the deficit that they're projecting has to do with the projected utilization of the clinic.
Yeah, the biggest thing was they were not being able to hire pediatricians. So, but when we had the site visit with them, the director there mentioned that she was actively recruiting pediatricians, so there wasn't a problem with that. So that's why we requested for the clinic's operational budget rather than the whole organizational budget, which we still haven't received yet. And they were supposed to get back to us with that.
And didn't we recommend that they collaborate with other
We had mentioned it and talked about it to them, but we wanted to see, we wanted to get this information first before we were taking maybe another step where we could actually have a pediatric collaborative. Because now we don't know with UCR School of Medicine, they've got their pediatric clinic, if that's going to be continuing, because I think that might have been a residency program, mm-hmm. the one in La Quinta. And I know VIM sends a lot of the children to Loma Linda because they take 18 and above. They were kind of rebuffed on that when they wanted to put information in with Loma Linda's lobby, and they said, no, you can't do that. So it's sort of a real silo operating type of play well with others in the sandbox. So that's why we really want to see these operating dollars before we make any kind of recommendation. Or
so we're on track to do that?
It's the ball's in the court, yes.
Okay.
We got an email from them about a month or so ago. They said they were working on it, so we'll get it soon.
Does anybody else?
Do have another question? I have a question about the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability grant. I wasn't aware that the Eastern Coachella Valley dollars are designated for core support. I didn't know that. But to access to primary care and behavioral health?
Mm-hmm. That was part of the RFP that went out.
Okay.
Yeah, specific to help core operating support for those organizations that do provide primary care and behavioral health care.
Okay. That's it for us.
We still want to try and get them involved, though, with the.
Okay, is there any other comments or questions? We'll move on to grant payment schedule.
This is a schedule that we normally had been putting into the board pack, in the program committee pack, as well as the board packet, but something we forgot the last couple of times, so now it's just an update of where we are, the grants that have been approved, and what is available for funding.
We'll be moving on to new business. Consideration to approve grant number 1045 by Blue Bank, ending 100 today, tomorrow, and for life.
Okay, this is a request from Fine Food Bank for 401-380. They are asking us again to support them with the kind of a continuation of what began 4 or 5 years ago with Project Produce. It was more the ending the hunger today by putting fresh produce into the different pantries and people can access healthy food. Debbie Espinoza, the CEO, is here, as well as Libby Sassana, who is the development person. And Debbie has come up with a really robust, interactive type of strategic plan, so if you will. By ending trying to end hunger forever. I don't know if that ever worked, but it's been broken down into 3 different categories: today, tomorrow, and lifetime. And so what they're asking the district to fund is staying with produce funding, as we normally have, and the other things are listed here as well. So Debbie is here. If you do have any questions or you want her to speak to the request at all.
And Lorena Mayor came just arrived. Sorry, there was a traffic accident which delayed them on Highway 1180 or whichever way you're going. But she's the Director of Community Impact, too, so she can answer. I can handle strategic questions for overall Fine Bank strategy as well as operational. Lorena can answer from the community impact side, which manages all the external programs for Fine Food Bank, that many of these are incorporated into the technical aspects of those two as well. So we want to be able to give you the overview and purview that you need to come over to help make a decision, whichever we decide.
Could you explain a little further how this funding would be? The 4 lifetime aspect that we put.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is really interesting about food banking and a lot of the work that we've been doing, we're as the regional food bank for the Feeding America National Network, as well as the regional food bank recognized by the state of California, we've done a lot of studies over the last decade with regards to really understanding cycle of poverty as well as cycle of food insecurity and equitable food distribution. So to be able to change and manage and flow through that, it really set up logic models to be able to address those issues. It was very important for us, and it's one of the reasons why we went down this road about 5-6 years ago with the Desert Healthcare District, because we were starting to understand the importance, not just of food distribution, but of meal distribution, balanced diet, and health in order to be able to achieve the outcomes that we were looking for. When you look at the Ending Hunger for Today programs, and I'm going to answer your question, but I need to explain this logic model. When you look at the Ending Hunger for Today, the importance of literally just putting nutritious food into the community to be able to take advantage of the programs that are being offered here and for tomorrow, being able to fill out CalFresh outreach applications, being able to fill out Medi-Cal applications, being able to take care of the outreach services that can provide more longer-term support, you can't do that if you're literally starving. So first and foremost, the critical need of feeding people nutritiously. Next is being able to give them the access to be able to get the government aid and supplemental support to be able to allow them to shop for themselves. And then lastly, to be able to try to look at the root causes of hunger that will eventually allow them to leave the cycle. Education, workforce development, financial literacy, housing are the things that Feeding America, in partnership with Annie Casey Foundation, Urban Institute, are really looking at. And having food banks at the regional levels look at those things too, with their large funding partners, to be able to understand how do you break cycles. For the dollars that we would be using over here, it would be in conjunction with what Desert Healthcare District is already doing with the nutrition education, because we see that nutrition education is for a lifetime, and supporting those programs being deployed into our Desert Healthcare District agency sites with their team of staff already, and then supporting with print materials as well as our own outreach workers going out and supporting that too as well. So that's how the dollars would be used specifically for the Ending Hunger. Paired with that, and what I think is very important for the committee to know, is that for many years, Find Food Bank has leveraged the dollars that DHCD has used to fund the west side of Cook Street to be able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for the east side of the valley. The importance of equitable food distribution throughout all of our communities is one of the charges that we have as a regional food bank, and not just equitable food distribution, equitable nutritious food distribution. So for the Ending Hunger for Tomorrow being funded by the produce, it weaves into supporting not just the programs that we're focusing on over here, both on the east and west side, but also the other programs that DHCD supports through the funding of both sides of the valley too as well. Without the Ending Hunger for Today, it will be very difficult for people to be able to take advantage of the Ending Hunger for Tomorrow and be able to break those cycles of poverty. And, you know, it's not just, at this point, it's not just breaking cycles of hunger, it's breaking cycles of poverty too as well, because they are going hand in hand. So we are also focusing on these other areas, but again, we use Desert Healthcare District's funding to help leverage funding to be able to take care of these things by telling them we already have a healthy base over here of nutritious foods going out to allow clients to be able to take advantage of this, both on the east and west side. For the specific grant, it will be for the west side. We are partnering already and have received a grant in partnership with UCR and Borrego to handle the east side for nutrition education through CORI, which is the Patient Centered Outcomes Research Institute. So we will be matching nutrition education by what's happening over here on the west side if this grant is funded, on the east side too as well. However, we did use Desert Healthcare District's funding on the side at the time that we applied for it last year in order to leverage that grant to get the PCORI and be a strong partner with UCR. So right now what we're doing is we're looking at a multifaceted approach to be able to pair some of our really strong heavy hitters that are equivalent with the scope of work that Find Food Bank is doing in the community to leverage all resources to be able to lift up the valley. in multiple ways, not just in food distribution, child, you know, being able to combat childhood obesity, being able to combat type 2 diabetes in multiple populations through the produce, but also to be able to work on these things as well. Long answer to a short question.
Thank you. It's a very good answer. I also appreciate that you will all be incorporating the CBHIP model into this body of work. I know we've been working really hard at it. That was one of the questions I had for Alejandro a month ago. It was just exciting that you actually put it in your proposal and you will be doing it right on here, so I appreciate that.
You know, it's interesting to CBHIP because, I've been doing food banking for a long time, but at the national level and the regional levels, just because I used to work for the National Office of Feeding America, I've had the opportunity to be able to see many, many different models of food banking. One of the problems, I think, of some of the food banks was that they weren't utilizing a central source within a community to be able to track client movement, because you can't just be in isolation as a food bank. So many food banks are in the process of looking for a way to be able to do this with their community partners. I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. Desert Healthcare District already has the platform. We will feed into that because I want to focus on these things since you guys are focusing on that. So, you know, strong partnerships and collaborations are a necessity. That's why we include CBHIP. We need to be able to see how clients are moving, how outreach workers are working together in order to make sure that we have a really spherical system that wraps around our clients' needs.
Any questions?
The eligibility requirements, are they consistent amongst all your...
Yes.
And can you just sort of say, give us a thumbnail sketch with eligibility requirements?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it's really a great question, because the state of California, especially because we're the USDA contractor from the state of California for the desert region of California, Riverside County specifically, I serve on the advisory committee to the state with regards to understanding poverty in the state of California for USDA federal programs that are administered through the state. We actually we have the second highest population of people in poverty, but we have the lowest income qualification out throughout the United States. So where other states were allowing people to go up to, you know, 180 to 200% of the poverty population, California was still at 135% of federal poverty line. Last year, me and about 10 people advised the state that that was not right or correct. So we were able to raise it to 235% of federal poverty line to be able to adjust the allowability of people in need to be able to access. So it's 235% that we use throughout all of our valley, much needed right now with cost of living going up so extremely in our area.
I know that there are 3 food banks in my little community. So a person can qualify for all 3 at once, is that how it works?
Yeah, so for us as the regional food bank, we supply actually probably 75 to 100% of all the food resources going to your local food banks, community shelters, CBR, Martha's, they're all of them, central all in the desert. If they're a USDA distributing agency, 235% is what they need. We try to have people use one agency or pantry system. There's about 140 sites throughout the valley, including 22 mobile markets that Fine Food Bank places out into the food desert areas of the community. But we try to have them go to one pantry, but when you really look at hunger and equitability of food distribution throughout the valley, sometimes they need a little bit more support than just going one time a month. So sometimes what they'll do is they'll access the pantry by their work, and then sometimes they'll access the pantry by their home. And what we do is we work with our agency partners and our local markets to be able to understand that everybody's situation is a little bit different, and that they would qualify at any of the pantries depending on what is most convenient to them. We don't want to have food deserts in the valley, so we try to do equitable distribution throughout to allow them to remove barriers for the clients most people.
I noticed that some of the pantries have refrigeration and others don't. is there some way to support the ones that do not have refrigeration?
Yeah, so I'm going to let Lorena talk about that. Use the USDA milk example in our little town.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've implemented is increasing our mobile markets. We are now at 22 distribution sites, and that's to offer support for those agencies that don't have refrigeration capacity. And then recently we implemented a new position. We got an influx of refrigerated milk and dairy products from USDA, and one of our warehouse guys turned into the milkman, and he was able to deliver to all of the agencies that didn't have refrigeration capacity. So he offered a just-in-time delivery to get that out in efforts to reduce the barrier of refrigeration.
Yes, we have a milkman now. So sometimes the influx of refrigerated product from the USDA comes in and out. So we don't want our agencies to necessarily use funds to build capacity when there might be an influx in and out of refrigeration. We try to be able to use our resources to pair with them in order for them to focus their resources on direct client distribution as opposed to logistical needs. Right now, actually, we're looking at doing agency capacity development grants through other funding sources. So some of our agencies that we see food deserts at, or an area where there's not a lot of refrigeration or freezer, for some of our top performing agencies to be able to do agency capacity grants for them to purchase freezers and coolers. Hopefully that will come in 2021.
Does anybody else?
I would like to make an observation for board members on page 27. And look at how much the district will be contributing to this project. Look at the staffing cost. We will be covering almost 50% of the staffing cost. There is a significant cost for other items in this project. And my largest concern is that we are in the midst of a public health crisis, and that we will need to be addressing how we're going to mitigate, treat, and contain the spread of the coronavirus. We're working right now with the Department of Public Health, with the hospitals, and with the clinics, with the homeless shelters, with senior centers, with all those people that are at the forefront of fighting coronavirus in Coachella Valley, and that we will need resources. We don't know what's the magnitude of that, but it's something that it's an emergency. And we have options on the table, which is to fund the complete ask of $401,000 or modify that amount. My recommendation would be to consider modifying that amount and not funding the 100% of the request until at least we have the opportunity to assess all the crises that we have facing us right now, and that we see no resources being allocated to our region from the county or from anywhere else.
And how do you, I noticed that I subscribe to Next-Door Neighborhood in my community, and sometimes somebody will post, you know, there's going to be a mobile food bank someplace at some time, but it's not consistent. You know, how do you get the word out of the availability of your program?
Sure. So a lot of the mobile markets, one, we always post through our website. Two, we will do actually door knocking. Many of our outreach workers go door to door with our mobile markets to ensure that the community understands and knows that it's there. We advertise through the local agencies too as well. Word of mouth for many of our food banks tends to be some of our best ways of advertising because people know people are delivering. So with regards to the consistency of social media messaging, a lot of the times people will ask, we'll go ahead and post there as well in order to get it out. We'll be developing in this upcoming year of social media ways of doing things. We actually just met with Cathedral City High School to work with interns there from their high school programs that need to do 30 hours in order to complete their senior projects. One of them will be actually social media and being able to get not just storytelling out, but the word out in our lives to them. So we're in the process of redoing that too as well.
I had another question. I was a volunteer in the Bay Area for another food bank, and they gave away frozen turkeys to the community, and they had people come and sign up, and then they just drive through with their car with their little paper saying they qualified, and we just put a frozen turkey and a box of food in their car. Is that up to the individual food banks to do that, or how?
Yeah, so we all do it in various ways. Sometimes it has to do with temperature too as well. So especially in the summertime, we're definitely modifying very differently than many of our sister food banks. And being from the Bay Area, actually, I know which food bank you're talking about. We have some of our agencies do global drive-throughs, St. Margaret's in Palm Desert, which is one of the EHCD agencies that receives produce from us through the Sunday. They do a global drive-through as well, receiving their bags of product.
Do you have any of them in the market or something? No, we have the drought program. We did our
So that's up to the individual
agencies to
initiate something like that.
You know, we wanted to try to pilot a drive-through mobile market where we're bringing in our truck and then they're driving through. But it's interesting. Many people actually like to get out of their cars and be able to associate with each other. Right now, actually, it's kind of funny because we're in the process of decreasing line size in order to help with regards to prevention of coronavirus. We are also working with the Department of Public Health, as well as State of California and Feeding America to be able to regulate lines. So we're only asking one person from each household to come to the distribution site. Others can stay in the car or out in the parking lot until the person is going through line. But typically people like to socialize. It's really interesting, especially our senior sites. We have, we saw a 7% increase with seniors this past year at our distribution sites. So they comprise 26% of our total distribution. It was a staggering statistic for us to see the increase, but economically we can understand, especially with people that are now retiring that weren't able to recover from the downturn of the economy in 2007. They didn't have enough ramp-up time to be able to resupply themselves with retirement funds. So many of them like to socialize as part of their exercise and health regimen to be able to go out. And in Corrado, I want to address what you're saying. I completely understand. We I just talked to Seattle. Our sister food bank, Food Lifeline, the Feeding America food bank up there, they're in a different mode right now just because of the Seattle Health Department and the questions that have been asked and what they've been asked to do. I understand what it is that you're asking for. If the board chooses to modify, because I understand the concerns, my only request would be that if for some reason we're able to contain it and control it, the help and support that we get with regards to staffing costs, it takes that much staff to be able to process 5 million pounds of produce. And the way that it looks here on the staffing cost, well, it's 50%. Remember, that's also leveraging the produce money to be able to serve the east side of the county too as well. So it's satisfying both sides of your district now. We still have to raise 50 to 75% on top of that in order to be able to make this program run. And we do that by leveraging the district dollars to be able to receive the rest of the money. So I get it. I can understand why you're making that request. Again, the only thing that I would ask is if we come to a point where you don't need the money, if we can look at it again to be able to reinvest back into this program. If we don't need to do that, that would be better because we ride a lot on leveraging this grant to be able to fund Eastside too as well.
When do you absolutely need these funds back? I know the end of the year is coming up.
Right. Well, we have, so right now, the Desert Healthcare District funds stopped in December 31 of 2019. So we've actually been carrying 100% of this program off of operational reserves and other funding streams, but not at 100%. It's one of the reasons why we actually carry a healthy reserve balance for cases like this where it might take a little bit of time or delay with regarding to funding patterns. So we'll carry the first quarter of this year actually all on our own. The sooner the better, because we need to make sure that we stay strong. A especially with regards to how the economical effects might happen with coronavirus, with many of our people losing jobs and hours through this time period. This is when many of them stock up on their savings to be able to make it through the summer months. So we are actually projecting a spike in our distribution lines come the May, June, July, August, and September months, especially if Coachella and Stagecoach are canceled too as well. So we may go back to the numbers that we saw at the time of the downturn of the economy in our valley, just because of the nature of what's going on right now and the loss of business. It won't be long-term like it was before, but we need to make sure that we're in a very healthy position to be able to support that with the produce and the food that's coming through. The other concern that we have right now too is that with all of the stores being cleared out, the flow of food that we get typically from retail stores as well as the distribution centers, we will see a major shift in donated food product and food rescue product. Our only supply that's staying healthy right now is the produce. So, which is great, because that's the healthy food that we want for people to have because of their immune systems and making sure that they're staying vigilant about staying healthy and fighting for viruses. So again, we want to work together as teams to be able to make it through this time period, but we're already projecting out shifts and imbalances that we haven't seen for a long time at the food bank, and we need to be prepared. So again, we've been funding for a quarter. Any longer, we're starting to draw down on reserves that I need to keep intact, just in case we need to start honestly purchasing food and purchasing more, paying for more transportation fees to bring in influx of produce to offset.
Would there be effects of malnourishment due to the coronavirus?
You know, it's interesting. I'm talking to some of the other Feeding America food banks. We have many of our disaster relief food banks that are a little worse than this. San Antonio, all of our Gulf State food banks, San Francisco, and the Northern California food banks that have been dealing with the fire. We've been talking about economic impact and how it will affect the lines, as well as malnutrition. What's different is that if people don't have access to food, we already still have people that are saying that they're missing meals or skipping meals, either because they were too embarrassed or too afraid to go to a food bank line, which we try to overcome that by our outreach workers. But if we have a decrease of food in our food distribution lines and we're starting to ration, just like all of the general public is rationing right now at the stores, my concern is that it will actually be our older population that might be the most affected by it, because they're staying indoors. They don't want to deal with the crowds that are coming out. They'll skip meals and just wait it out a little bit to the point of not even realizing they're malnourished until the day that they are. And we don't have that much of a skip population. It's a lot of times.
And they're among the most vulnerable, as you're aware, to coronavirus. So they are being cautionary and staying indoors more, as they've been recommended.
So we'll have to work together. Food Bank, Healthcare District, County of Riverside, we're going to have to work together with regards to not just the response right now with regards to coronavirus, but the nutritional effects that it's going to take a toll on. If we're seeing major decreases with regards to food resources for the point of food out into these communities as part of the recovery phase. So right now we're in the response phase as part of the recovery phase. That's where we're all going to still continue to have to come together.
Conrado, could you clarify your recommendation again about this grant?
So I understand and I value the work that is being proposed. My number one concern is that we are carrying a significant percentage of the cost of this as the sole funder. When you look at the amount of funding that other funders are putting into this project, is $25,000, $50,000, and we are being asked $400,000. When we are in a time in which we need to be very vigilant of what we need to do to address the coronavirus crisis that we have knocking on our door, or already inside our house. And my recommendation would be to fund 75% of what it's been asked rather than the full 100% amount that it's been asked, so that we are conservative and we're prudent in how we're using our funds to address the coronavirus crisis.
Well, my personal opinion is that this Fund Food Bank is one of our signature grant programs that this healthcare district has always funded. And we have surplus of funds available that have not been requested.
But we don't know yet.
My question is, sorry, keep going.
Well, I just think that we have a grant proposal on the table. It's been vetted by 3 staff people and given excellent reviews. And it isn't as if we don't have funds available for other programs. And maybe what we ought to do is, as a board, recommend that we come up with an investment fund just to specifically set aside for the coronavirus efforts, public health efforts that this district could use to promote other programs in the valley, because it is an emergency. And you know, maybe we should set aside $1 million in emergency funding, because this is, you know, something that's just happening to us once in our lifetime, as far as I can see. And I think that we should fund the entire request.
I think that regarding the setting aside $1 million or X amount of dollars, it's a larger conversation. I would advise against adding additional dollars from our reserves, because we have a huge responsibility with the seismic retrofit of the hospital. And if we take from our cash reserves monies that we might need in the future, if we have to retake the hospital, I think it's going to hurt the district more deeply. So that is my observation on
well, I think
on
you
that
know, you've always heard me talk about the need for cash reserves for a seismic retrofit of this hospital. And we know that there are hospital districts in California that submit bonds that are readily available to retrofit, to build hospitals, that I don't think that's ever going to be an issue for us. So, you know, I think that we ought to look at those reserves as something that is okay to set aside, but we can always use them to obtain other bond funding if we ever have to take over the hospital.
I think this is a philosophical debate that we as a district should engage on and look at the whole context of taxing our communities. Number one, we're living times that are going to have a profound effect in our economy. So we don't know our capacity to issue any bonds if we have to retrofit the hospital. So that's one major concern. I think the second consideration for that is that there is a proposal that it's being circulated in our community about creating our own independent taxing district, independent from the county, and that will also have some implications for the ability of the district to issue bonds, because it will require voter approval. And the financial stability of our economy, it's something that I'm questioning right now very profoundly. We don't know what's going to happen. The economic impact worldwide of coronavirus has been significant. I was on the phone with a friend who's the director of public health in Orange County, Florida, and he was telling me that over 48 hours they had cancellations of events that were worth $400 million. We had a similar effect here. In 24 hours, we had the cancellation of the tennis tournament with an economic impact of $400 million. If we have to cancel that, Coachella Fest is going to be also another big one. There is some other festivals that we might be canceling, and the economic impact on our region is going to be severe. And we're looking at it only from a regional perspective. This is going to be exactly the same nationwide. We don't know what our economy is heading with something so difficult to assess as what we're facing right now.
Maybe we should have a conversation with people who are, have expertise in bonds. I know that I sat on a district board in Northern California where we issued private bonds. And private bonds are a good tax-free investment right now. And, well, not tax-free, where they pay good interest. Our healthcare district issued a bond for $150 million, did not go to the voters. We used it to build a medical office building in Pleasanton. It's standing today, so if that wasn't, I mean, there are bonds available, there's ways to obtain money, and I think that maybe this conversation should go to the direction where we can talk about that.
I have a question for you, and then the other one's for me, and I'm going to have it about your scoring. You scored 7 on... First, my question to you. Do you foresee us getting a request that would require us to spend the $2.6 million in the grant budget line item that we have?
There would be other requests. We have a list of other organizations that are already submitting letters of intent. And
regarding the coronavirus, I can easily
anticipate at least $1 million that I'm going to have a meeting with LabCorp to see how we can set up an infrastructure locally to provide rapid testing for our community. So we don't know how costly that can be. And also diverting medical visits from the ER, because that's where the cross-contamination is going to happen. The hospital are trying to prepare themselves, creating or converting hospital rooms into negative pressure rooms so that there is no spread of infectious diseases. But, you know, our community clinics, our schools, our nursing homes, our homeless shelters, they're all going to be impacted by this.
There's no supplies also. No hand sanitizers, no masks,
yep.
Gloves.
So we'll probably end up having some of that responsibility.
Yes.
I have a question for you all. If we do not provide you 100% of the funding today, how will you make up the difference?
If we go at 75% and we have to make up 25%, it's going to be an extra $100,000 that we'll have to already look at. You know, we're already carrying off the reserves. We'll probably be off of those reserves, as well as trying to find another funder. I don't want to decrease Request Services, especially right now, because of what is going on and the impact that it's having in our community, especially in the process of trying to prepare for the inevitable, which is the spike in the lines. We can't stop doing what we're doing, so literally we're just going to have to find a way. I would hope that there would be a funder that would step up, because I'd have the release information that we can get the funding from, you know, sources that we were typically strong partners with. But you know what, I respect the fact, I understand the conversations that are coming. I just hope that we don't have to go through that, because we have to focus on the preparation of sites. I wish I could give you a better answer.
That's a good answer. Thank you. And then for staff, your scoring sheet, just on how to do it again. Percent of funding request to be put with 7.
Yeah, just echoing with the Conrado's concern of how we're carrying the majority of the funding. So I felt that, you know, in comparison to the other funds that are being brought in by other grants and other foundations that they've secured thus far, I think it was a little bit more of us carrying some of that burden, so that's why I scored it at 7.
Yeah, it's almost 40%. I think some of mine is geared towards more sustainability. Some of the questions that you were just asking, and Debbie, we've talked to Debbie several times about it, and if you look, we did include the history of the amount of money that we funded, so that's where I was scoring a little bit lower, because the conversation about what happens if we can't, you'd have to find it, but there's no like clear answer, which you can't predict things like that.
What's interesting, we talked about this. I actually, this model that we've been running with Desert Conference over the last few years is actually seen as one of the model programs in the United States with regards to produce distribution and healthy meals. I actually presented on an international conference this past year because of the partnerships between a healthcare district or a healthcare organization and a food bank, which isn't necessarily the standard with many of the food banks around the country, because a lot of the healthcare industries don't understand the importance of produce going out into the world. It's interesting because with regards to the sustainability, part of the sustainability of produce going out is the partnerships that Fine Food Bank and the food banks have with their local healthcare organizations to understand that if you propel an organization into a realm where they're actually probably a decade more advanced than some of the other food banks within the United States because of the way that they're doing it, that is part of the sustainability question, is it's the longevity of a partnership that can go on. We are a nonprofit organization. We start at zero every year. Sustainability is our ability to develop partnerships for people to see the long-term effect of what can happen when two organizations or foundations or community partners or individuals are engaged together in order to make a difference in the community. That is part of sustainability. So, you know, if we're asking the question, how will we replace the funds, we're going to have to do it, but we're also going to have to reconsider the fact that we may have to decrease produce, because part of our partnership was the idea that it would be a sustainable partnership too as well. It's not just about money. It's about a unified vision of making sure that we're helping Desert Healthcare District achieve their needs of ensuring that there's equitable, healthy food distribution throughout the valley through the resources that we have the ability to be able to provide. It's a $1 million program, but you can't see it as just a $1 million program, because if you look at the value of produce that we're bringing into the community as well as the rest of the food, we actually bring in over $19 million worth of donated product. If I have the ability to put into this budget 5 million times $1.67, you actually increase the budget to $7 million program. But that staffing that you have there is also our resourcing to bring in donated produce. Remember, this is about paying for the transportation fees of rescuing produce from all over the state of California as well as through the West Coast to be able to bring it down into our valley. This is actually more of a $7 to $8 million program. So you're only funding, and I know it's weird with the numbers, but those are audited numbers. You can go to our financials, and if you go to our financials, you'll see the value of donated food in there. We take a look at the whole thing. If you tried to do this by purchasing the produce, added an extra $7 million to that. That's the meaning of the partnership and the sustainability.
I think this is a bad time to be reducing funding for food for people who are needy in our valley. And I make a motion that we accept the $401,380 proposal.
I second. It's really hard for me to sit here and like have to put both of these things into perspective with each other. However, there is $2.6 million in our grant line item, in our budget for grants. I think $400,000 and the $1 million plus that we're getting requests, like we will, this is, it's very difficult to say like people who go hungry will not be affected by the coronavirus at malnutrition. It seems like we would be creating, we would not be helping people if we can't help with this one project. However, as we get further like requests for the funding and things of that nature, yeah, this is definitely a conversation that I'll keep in mind. I appreciate you bringing up a like, very thoughtful way to this, but I'm Carolyn, so I'm not sure this is the right time to not fund this program.
It's almost like it's indirect. Food is indirect, but it's causal from a direct service provider.
Yes, the cause and effect might outweigh a couple thousand dollars for us.
I'd like to second that, but I also have a couple of questions as part of the discussion. And that is, do we have the ability to revisit current grants that have been committed and ask and holding back any funding because of the coronavirus?
I don't know that we can do that. It will be a very difficult process to make from a legal standpoint, from a political standpoint too. I think it will be very difficult.
So, okay. So if we were to hold back funds here, it would be to victimize, and that's not pejorative, but victimize the timing of this request.
I don't think that it's victimizing the timing of this request. We're talking about an organization that has received nearly $6 million over time of support from the district. So it's not that we're victimizing Fine Food Bank or any other organization. I think it's being prudent with the times that we're living.
How long do you think it will be before you start receiving concrete requests related to the coronavirus?
Hours?
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Hours.
Perhaps we could recommend something to the board to put together an emergency fund.
Well, that's what staff is working on.
Okay.
We don't have a concrete plan. We don't have a concrete number, but that's what we're working on, Scott. And we have been working for the last 2 weeks to present something
to the
board. Yeah.
And maybe we could make that a recommendation from the program committee that the board consider a proposal from staff for emergency funding and with a plan.
Well, I think that we will have a clearer idea over the next 72 hours to 96 hours, so that we can prepare to bring something to the attention to the board at the next board meeting. And if something, a true emergency happens, I think we have mechanisms that we can trigger to expedite some of that process. For example, we have funding that has been allocated to a homelessness initiative. So if we find that homeless shelters are needing some emergency funding, that we can probably work from those funds that have already been allocated, and that the homelessness initiative has total control over those funds. And anything else, we can also call for an emergency meeting on the board.
Do I have a motion to approve?
We already got a motion and a second.
Just need to take a vote.
Everybody in the
room? Do we need a...
All in favor?
We never have the...
Okay. Aye.
It's very difficult for you to go one way or the other because I don't know enough about what we might be involved in, because this is so important that what you're saying is really important. But when is it and how much? And to try to weigh those two things in this meeting is very difficult. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll just keep my mouth shut.
So based on the approval that has been approved, I moved on to the board.
Yes.
the one more good.
Oh, committee member comments. Are there any committee member comments at this time?
I have a handout. For committee members, two of them, they're two-sided.
So is it okay?
We're done.
Thank you, guys. I just think on behalf of all the agencies that receive the produce, you know, there's over 140 distribution sites as agencies across the county. So we're not just representing ourselves, we're representing those agencies too as well. So thank you all. So we appreciate it.
One more handout. And one is for Alessandria.
She'll give you that.
My two handouts, the first one is some research that I did with, I looked at other healthcare districts in California and the ones that have community advisory committees. And for your information, the board policy committee is going to recommend that we disband the community members on the program committee. And that's what the page 15 to 17 is, where you see the things that have been crossed out. And if you look at some of the links of other healthcare districts where they state the reason why they have community participation, oversight committee, district transparency, ways in which the community impacts decision making on the board process. You know that I've always been an advocate for transparency by elected boards, and I noticed doing the research that school districts in California are required to have community advisory committees. So I just wanted to bring this to your attention, and if any of you feel the way I do about keeping the healthcare district community advisory committee intact, I have a recommendation that community advisory committees and board members can sign to support my plea before I go before the board, the next board meeting, if you would agree with me.
Is there indeed a page 16 and 17?
Yeah, that's out of the policy, and it has to do with the program committee only. So
okay, what you handed out is just page 14 and 15.
Right, and that's because it starts out with volunteer member guidelines. It has to do with the program committee membership, and it's part of our policy. If you go to the district website, to the policies, you can look at the whole thing, and it just for in essence to have concise information for you. And I can send you the documents, and you can click on the links if you're interested in seeing what other districts in the state have, what they do. That's basically, I wanted to bring that to your attention.
Can we take an action like that for items on the agenda?
I'm sorry?
I don't think that this committee can take an action. Number one, it's not an item that is on the agenda. So.
Correct, yeah. This is just advisory, and it would be your personal opinion as to whether you think that community advisory committee members should be discontinued on this committee. And that's what I'm objecting to.
And I guess I'm not aware. Where is the movement of discontinuing participation coming from?
I think that it's something that has been talked amongst the board and has not been set in motion yet, which way we're going. So I think we should probably I mean, my opinion would be to just wait to see how this plays out, because we haven't got all the information yet on everything, on how we're gonna, how we're trying to move forward and how we're trying to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, except the board policy committee did make a recommendation to go to the board to disband.
Is there a particular reason for this action? I mean, I would think that a public body would want input from public representatives. Is there a specific reason that this is being entertained?
Sorry, this might just be me, but this feels like we're breaking the Brown Act. I don't know if you sit on the policy committee or not, but I don't sit on the policy committee, and it feels like
the minutes have been recorded and they're on the website.
Public, yeah.
On the policy committee, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Sure.
I think that the proper course is to discuss it at the board meeting, where those policies will be presented
exactly
in public. So.
Excuse me, the minutes are not on the website. They have not been
approved. So the minutes have not even published.
No, they will be approved at the board meeting. So I don't know.
My only reason for bringing this up was for community members to know that it has been proposed and to get support for my position, which is not to disband community members.
Yes, but the community members do not know yet because they haven't read what's going on. So they don't, this is like something coming out of the, you know, I don't know. They don't know, they don't have sufficient information, I think, to make, to be able to make that decision. Do you feel like you have?
I don't complain about it. It seems to me that having community members and organizations like this, just politically, it gives board members cover. That it's been discussed with the public, and the public has said some amount of time that, you know, somebody heard and somebody said, and to not have that, you're functioning without a safety net. But I don't know anything about this.
It was on the agenda for the policy committee for the board that met, and the agenda item and the packet is on the board website along with the recording conversation, so that's all public.
So I'm gonna, with what has been said, I'm gonna adjourn the meeting for today, and I will leave this for the board. We're at the board meeting, but I'll go over it. Okay, so meeting adjourned. Does anybody need a few minutes to go to the restroom or anything, or do you want to
continue? I didn't use as much on the
agenda. There's not much on the agenda, but
that's great. Oh, we're going to do the CD investigation.
Committee has a policy of limiting speakers to no more than 3 minutes. The committee cannot take action on items not listed on the agenda. Public input may be offered on an agenda item when it comes up for discussion and or action. Are there any public comments at this moment? Okay, so we'll move on to new business, our CBHIP presentation.
All right. Well, just
per director or vice president Borja's request, just provide you guys with a brief update of what's happening with our CBDEP project. I don't believe we have presented to this committee or even to the board on the new platform. I know, you know, some of you are familiar with it because of the work that you do during your day jobs, but just wanted to provide you a quick presentation on the new platform landing page and also some analytics of how the platform is performing. So this is what our landing page looks like. This is what the public sees. This is our landing page. So it has a logo here at the bottom, and it's consistent with the branding that Connect IE and IEHP have established. So just kind of give you guys a little bit of background. Last year in May, the board and staff decided to move away from our previous software developer, Healthify, for various reasons. One of the primary reasons being that we were engaging in a project that had additional add-ons that IHP and their Connect IE platform that were just getting started. With Ann Bertha, who is a new software developer. They were contracting with Ann Bertha to establish this database and this platform. And they were in their very initial stages where we already had 2 years of work, you know, on CBHIP. So we had a very robust database. We had 400 organizations that roughly provided anywhere between 1,500 to 1,600 services here locally. So we entered an agreement with IEHP to use the new platform. But we wanted to keep our branding and the name here, CBHIP, because as many of you know, and a lot of us here in the Coachella Valley don't identify as the LN Empire. So, and plus we already had invested some serious money into the branding of CBHIP, and we wanted to ensure that we kept some of the branding. So the partnership is with IEHP, 211 Riverside, 211 San Bernardino, and the LN Empire Health Information Organization. So it's a collaborative. We have Monday meetings to talk about the database, performance issues, etc. So this is what you're looking at. This is what the public sees. It's mobile friendly. You could use it from your iPad. You could use it from your phone. So very simple. You have two search boxes. One search box is for the service that you're looking for. The second search box is for the service, I mean for the zip code. And then this also can be translated into Spanish. So once you try to translate it into Spanish and you put in your comida and the zip code, the algorithm will recognize that you're utilizing the Spanish language setting, so it'll generate the search results for you in Spanish.
Don't forget there's 93 other.
There's other 93 other different languages, and I'll show you where you can see those things. So very simple to use. So for example, let's use food. Okay, and I don't know, let's say NU, 9201. Okay, so it opens up another web page for us. And for those of you that are familiar with Yelp, this has a Yelp feel to it. The first thing that we always want to do is click closest. Okay, so the search results are now closest to my zip code that I inputted, which is NU 9201. So one of the programs here, let's say, neighbors for neighbors food distribution. So what you see here is a program profile card that gives me very basic information about a service. It gives me the name of the particular service, who provides the service, a 1 or 2 sentence description of that service. Here sometimes you'll see their phone number. In this case, we see their physical address. If I want to know a little bit more about this particular organization, I click on more info, and it's going to give me a more detailed analysis of what this organization provides and the availability and the eligibility criteria. So for example, the eligibility is anyone can access this program. The availability, the program is available here. If there's a wait list, there's no capacity, you will see that on there. Here's a little bit more description of what the program provides. The primary language is spoken at this organization, the cost, the website, the coverage area, and most important, when it was last updated. So this piece of information or this particular program was last updated January 14, 2020, so less than 2 months. And that's a very key piece of information, especially for social workers, case managers, community health workers, promotores, that are out in the field and they're using the system, because a lot of them, we're replacing pretty much their resource binder that a lot of these organizations and individuals utilize to try to refer individuals to outside of the scope of services that they provide in-house in their own organization. So for them to actually see that timestamp and say, wow, this is a service that has been updated. So I feel confident providing this information to somebody. If I would see 2018, 2017 on there, I always recommend to the staff that I'm presenting to maybe you want to call them first. But we have established a system through the help of Aunt Bertha. They have 80 tech representatives that will call the organizations every 6 months to ensure the information is up to date. And if the information is not up to date, they send me an email saying, hey, Alejandro, this organization needs, you know, to update their information on their program profile, or that the program was grant funded and the grant wasn't renewed, that they completely disabled the program from the database so it no longer appears on the searches. So, and we're also able to provide, and part of the work that I've been doing is working with organizations to provide them, for example, food services here in Martha's Village and Kitchen. You'll see the little blue check mark. So if you see a little blue check mark, that means that I've met with this organization, I provided them with administrative access so they could update the information on their own without waiting for that 6 month call from the Aunt Bertha team. They could actually update the information there on their own, and they actually, you know, could edit and update, you know, if there's a new program or service, they're actually able to edit that information themselves. So it's a really, really nice thing.
Alejandro, are you aware of the changes that they make? Are you able to see that?
Yes, we're able to, on my end, I'm able to get really detailed analytic reports of when an organization actually updates their profile. Yes. So for example here, let's say we have food services, you know, we want to share this information, we can share it one of three ways. We could click print view, and the system puts everything into a printable format, everything that was on the more info tab. So it puts it in a very easy to read format that includes hours of operation, a map. Okay. Or let's say, and this is where a lot of the case managers and social workers love this system, because now I could actually share this resource via email or text message. Okay? So it's really, really neat. So all you have to do on the service provider end, you have to provide your name, your email, who you're sending it to, and then you could actually put a little brief message at the bottom here. It says, hey Alejandro, this is the service that we talked about during our meeting today. Please call them or visit them at your earliest convenience, right? So what the recipient is gonna get, they're gonna get a hyperlink to this particular service. So they're not gonna get just a go to cbhip.com for search for services. They're gonna get a hyperlink directly for this service. Also, on the other end, on the text message, you just provide your name and then who you're sending it to, and once again, the system will generate a text message with a hyperlink on there saying, hey, Alejandro is sharing this resource with you. Please click on the hyperlink, and it'll open it up directly to what they're looking at.
Where's
okay.
The referral piece going to come in?
The referral piece, great question. So, for example, let's say, Fine Food Bank. Okay, for their CalFresh Outreach and Case Management Program, if I click contact, then I'll be able to actually refer somebody here. Okay.
And is a piece in there now too, where you can track to see if that person was actually tied into the referral?
Mm-hmm. And I'll show you that. For example, so once an organization completes this, then what you'll get is, so with staff members, you got a little bit ahead of me now.
I'm sorry.
it's okay.
We're talking about.
So the referral, so what I'm able to do too is set up teams within organizations. You know, I set up teams with Desert Age Project, Fine Food Bank, Link of Instituto del Pueblo, and other service providers that have outreach teams. So I'm able to create teams within that organization. So like Donna was mentioning, they're able to track the referrals that they're sending out to other organizations. And they'll be able to do, because each staff member will create their profile, and then they can see their caseload here on the left-hand side. It'll auto-populate. So I have a couple of client tests that I use for my demos when I'm out in the community doing these presentations. So we click on client demo number 13. So here's what they're able to see. They're able to see the personal information of the individual. They've actually established goals for that particular individual. And then at the bottom, they're going to be able to see where they have referred this individual to. Okay. So here, they're actually able to update the status. Referral to food pantry at the Cathedral Center. This was referred by Alejandro on March 6, 2020. So if they got help, I can update the information here. They can say they got help, they're not eligible, there was no capacity, the individual was no longer interested, etc. Okay, so it's a really, really nice way for organizations that do not have case management software to be able to utilize this and be able to monitor and track outgoing referrals and be able to follow up with those individuals if they don't see that their status has changed on the system.
So CBRM is hooked into this, correct? And I'm
yes.
only getting because people are having some difficulty referring IHP client and then weren't getting anything back. And so if the vet could use this and use the system to really track this one particular client that she was trying to get.
If the organization decides to utilize the electronic referral system, then yes, they're able to. But right now some organizations are hesitant because they have to have a dedicated staff person that is going to be receiving all of these incoming referrals. And internally, they have to create a protocol or a system of how this is going to work. Because the last thing is, because we don't want for these referrals to be going out to CVRM and then not having an individual that is dedicated to solely making sure that these individuals are getting the help that they need or they're being referred.
So I'm sorry to keep asking these questions because I don't want to ask them
no,
staff
great.
Time. But so how would then, so just I'm going to use this hypothetical again. So Yvette sends a referral to CVRM, but maybe CVRM doesn't have a dedicated staff person, so the referral just sits there. Is there a little thing that pops up since they don't have a designated person or they don't?
It does.
They can't.
So the system will automatically tell you, for example, let's go back here. So the system will tell you that this program does not have, for example, you're the food voucher program for AAB Food Samaritans. If I click next steps, they'll say log a referral. I'm referring somebody else. And then I input all of the information on here. So let's go with the client. Demo. Then Espinosa. Plus. Demo at dkcd.org. So see here, there's a prompt. It says this referral will not be sent out to the program. This program does not accept referrals. We use this information to just save. Okay. And once I click save, it's going to remind me once again, okay, in big red letters, that this program currently does not have. Okay, this program does not have an email address listed. We'll try to contact them another way, but please follow up with them directly to get in touch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
there's not just
stuck.
Exactly. So there's not just referrals floating out in the cyberspace. So they are telling the folks, and this is more to log a referral for internal use to say, hey, so you are able to follow up. Opposed to, I found that some organizations use Excel spreadsheets, some use binders where they're writing the information of where they actually referred each individual to. This actually is going to give them the ability to actually just house that information and be able to monitor and track where these referrals are going to.
So I just logged on to see if I could refer someone. So what prevents a bunch of people from just referring to all these sites? And their people getting these and thinking they're real. Hopefully no one would do that, but there's all sorts of things out there. That's,
yeah.
That's scary that I can.
So this is also for the public. So that's why when we said the log the referral, it asks you if it's for you or for somebody else. So this is someone, if I'm out of the public, if I'm a public member, and I want to refer my aunt, my mom.
I'm talking about idiots who take advantage of this and are bombarding the organizations with referrals that aren't real. Because there's people maybe that's something to check, because that would be really bad if CBRM just got 100 referrals and they think they're real.
Mm-hmm.
And following up, and there goes 40 hours of someone's staff time. I don't want anyone to stop wanting to use the referral system.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to log in now?
Huh?
I didn't have to log in.
Well, she can create her own. Yeah, because this is what, this is all what we're seeing, this is the public facing. You know, in order to actually to get that private data, it is HIPAA secure. That's why each staff member has to have their own login information, just like I can. But the referral, you know, it's open, and that's what we want. We want the public to be able to refer themselves or somebody else to the services that they're searching for. But you know, I'll bring it up at the next Monday meeting that we have to see exactly how we can filter some of those things out. All right. Any other questions so far? No? So, so this is what it looks like. So each organization has all of these program profile cards, and we decided to do individual programs, not organizations. So for example, if I want to know all the programs that the Galilee Center provides, I just click on Galilee Center. It's going to filter out everything else, and it's just going to give me the services that Galilee Center provides. They have the four programs on here. Okay. And then like Donna mentioned, this language is available in well over 100 different languages. So let's say somebody is looking for information in Chinese, it translates the information in Chinese. So if I want to print it, email it, or text it, it's going to recognize the language that you're utilizing it, it's going to send the information in that particular language. Okay. So it's really, really neat. Another way that you can do searches is that you don't have to, you can do a search by a category or an organization. So let's say if I want to look for Mizell, okay, and I could actually search by organization as well. Okay, so I click on Mizell, and now I have all the programs and services provided by Mizell. They just rebranded themselves. They're not the senior center anymore. It's called Myself Center. They got a new logo in here. Another great thing is that if I don't know what I'm searching for, we have the social determinants of health on top there on the blue bar. If you hover over any little icons, it's going to give you different drop-down menus. For example, food, you've got community gardens, emergency food, food delivery, food pantries, how to pay for food, meals, and nutrition education. So each little icon is going to have those drop-down menus. Obviously, money is one of the largest ones. And then now to our analytics. Okay. So far in the last 30 days, we have a total of 638 users on our database.
Individual
users, yes. And how does the system differentiate between multiple users? It utilizes cookies. Right? So they know that the IP address is just one IP address that it's recognizing. So, you know, I don't have, 638 bots that are out there, searching for stuff. It is 638 unduplicated unique users that are currently accessing the program. And it's primarily just service providers. When we started in June, let me see here, of last year, we started with 249. And as you can see, our trend line, we have some peaks and valleys. But we did some, outreach, and then this is what we're currently at. We started at 250, now we're at 638. So we've almost, tripled our audience. And this is only service providers. We only did a test pilot public marketing campaign with O'Bailey Communications, which was very on-screen centric. And now we're planning to do another public marketing campaign with KSQ and Telemundo, where we're going to be doing radio, TV, and digital ads in English and Spanish, hopefully starting with the Board of Directors on April 1st. Yeah. So these are solely, so we have 638 public service providers that are utilizing the system.
How did we migrate CBHIP data into IE data?
To IE, great question. So when we were in communication and negotiations with IEHP, we signed an MOU with them, stating that we are the owners of our database and the information that we provided. And they gave me a spreadsheet where I was able to take all the information that we had from our previous software developer, Healthify. So I was able to get, because we own our data. When we ended the contract with Healthify, that was one of the things that I asked for, is to give me a database and an Excel spreadsheet. And that's what I sent over to IEHP with an MOU stating that we are the owners of this data. Anytime IEHP decides to no longer fund the program, then we're able to get our database, and at that time we want to continue funding it on our own, we're able to do that. So right now we are not paying anything at all to manage the database. We were paying a $43,000 service fee to Healthify that now IEHP is paying for. And pretty much what the district is paying for is just my staff time to go out there and engage and work with the organization to set up the teams, to give them the administrative access, et cetera. And what you have in your folders there are the brochures, the pen, and a reference guide that I leave with the organizations once I give them a presentation. So they're able to go into the database, and they're able to navigate it and be able to also suggest programs, add programs, all these other different features that are within the database. So
very cool.
Very cool.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. It's been a lot of work.
Carol? Sorry? Had to leave.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so moving on to old business. Update from the homeless initiative.
The homeless initiative, the last subcommittee meeting, there was the introduction of, and this is a big policy conversation. At the last subcommittee meeting, there was the introduction of the idea of creating an independent taxing district for Coachella Valley, independent from going to the rest of the county. So we could create a tax district for Coachella Valley that would provide, and I think the introduction or the justification to create this conversation was homelessness and creating a housing fund. I think it's misdirected from my perspective, because it's the initial impetus of creating this new taxing district is about creating a housing fund, addressing low-income housing for Coachella Valley as a way to address homelessness in Coachella Valley. Both Director Velada and myself talked about the importance of looking at homelessness as a more complex issue that has a significant interaction or interface or intersection with behavioral health services, that people that are homeless, they do not get to a homelessness state only because there is no housing available. That housing is an important component and that we should pay attention to that, but we cannot just believe that we're going to tax ourselves to resolve the issue of the high cost of housing in Coachella Valley. That if we're going to address homelessness, we need to look at how are we going to provide healthcare services, not only behavioral health services, to that population, and how, if we want to fight homelessness in Coachella Valley, we also need to look at the regional development of resources that make Coachella Valley a more attractive place for better jobs. It's not only because we create low-income housing we're going to solve the issue of people's affordability of houses. If we continue to depend on an economy that is based on hospitality and agriculture, those are very low-paying jobs that we are supporting. So we should look at a master plan that will bring better jobs, better income, better ways to address the housing affordability in Coachella Valley, and also the access to healthcare services. We cannot forget that we expanded the district to cover the entire Coachella Valley, and that was with the same revenue that the district has from the same community. So if we're going to promote this independence from the county in intervention in how we tax ourselves in Coachella Valley, that it should be a larger conversation, not only creating a housing fund. So that is something that Supervisor Victor Manuel Perez is promoting. So it came from his office. And my recommendation is that we keep engaging ourselves in that conversation, forming this process and trying to build a larger coalition in which we're looking at this from a more global perspective and not with a narrow focus of let's build affordable housing and we're going to solve all the problems that we have with Coachella. That's the report I have on this.
Have we looked at in the district where to kind of complete those holes in terms of where the services are? I know that we have many, many nonprofit organizations that offer
services. We have an anecdotal information about that. That's why we're doing a community health needs assessment. At the end of that process, we're going to know exactly where those gaps are and what the community wants in their regions. So we want the community to be the informants and the decision makers of what services and where those services should be located. So we're going to have a more comprehensive plan for the future that we can utilize as a way to inform our policymakers about the needs in our communities, and that strengthening the healthcare district is strengthening the healthcare infrastructure that our community needs.
I guess I just get frustrated because I work with individual homeless people and see, and I've said this before at CBAG committee, that I realize that we're policymakers and we collect data and we do community needs assessment at the same time. What are we doing now? We've got the summer months coming up ahead of us. Have we heard who's working on cooling centers? I know we desperately need portable toilets. I asked Christy of Palm Springs City Council and she said that the portable toilets like they have in San Francisco cost $50,000, and that's going to take a lot of quarters to pay for it, something like that. So, you know, and we have not only coronavirus, but we also have hepatitis and all those public health issues out there that we need portable toilets, we need portable showers, you know. So I'm always asking, what are we doing now to help the homeless people? And I don't get an answer.
There's no answer. There isn't. Sometimes you can help them, sometimes you can't, sometimes.
Well, during the time that I have been in this position, what I have been trying to accomplish is not only that we understand and document the needs that we have in our Coachella Valley, but also that we build an infrastructure plan. How are we going to move forward? What is the plan to address the needs of different populations? And very importantly, that we use an equity lens so that we're not putting the same resources on the same group of people or the same group of organizations, because if we continue to do the same expecting different results, we're not going too far.
And
so having that plan and having an estimate of how much it will cost to build a
robust healthcare infrastructure in Coachella Valley is the only tool, or at least one of the most important tools we can have to address the disparities that we as an organization are facing by not being able to access revenues that are being collected and that should come to the district to support the work that we're doing.
Good point. Well, the other point is that it's not our legal responsibility, it lies in the lap of the Riverside County Health Department. And yeah, I think they think that their responsibility ends at Whitewater or something, that it doesn't go beyond Coachella Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's always been a problem for us to support public health services that legally belong in the lap of the county.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
One of the challenges that I think of raising, you know, like this tax for homelessness, actually building affordable housing comes before every city council, whose planning departments have to approve the building of those. So you can have the money, but if you don't have the political will in the cities, and there are certain cities in this valley who never have and never will mm-hmm. meet their affordable housing commitments, and there are other cities that do. So it's not only a funding issue, but it's if they're not going to approve affordable housing, it's not going to get built.
Mm-hmm. It's a very complex issue. It is a very complex issue.
Does anybody else have any comments or questions about information? So we'll move on to behavioral initiative update information.
All right. On the behavioral health initiative, we are in the process of identifying the candidates that we're going to hire. One of the issues that we're facing is the need for space, so we're also exploring how we can have a satellite office of the district outside of our main office in Palm Springs, an office that is located in a more central location, so that the persons that we place in that office can have access to the entire Coachella Valley, or at least an easier access. Instead of traveling 1 hour to the east, they can travel 30 minutes to the east and 30 minutes to the west.
I noticed there's an empty office in the Rap
Valley.
Sorry, did you mean Palm Desert?
Yes, Palm Desert.
The Rap Valley.
So what we want to have is an office probably at the Rap Foundation,
okay.
Where we have already an office. But it's no, what I said is to have a larger presence outside of Palm Springs.
Okay, gotcha.
And I just said, mentioned that RAP Foundation has empty space.
Yes, so. Yes, and we already have an office there, but it's not sufficient. It's small, so we probably have to move from that smaller location to a larger one, where we can have more space.
Inside the building?
Inside the building, yes.
Perfect.
So we're assessing that.
And the person that you're looking to hire is as a consultant or as an employee?
It's an employee of the district.
Okay.
That's what the board approved. Yeah. And actually, we're hiring for three positions that have been approved by the board. The senior program officer that will be in charge of behavioral health, a development officer who's going to be looking at the collective impact and attracting or leveraging funds from the county and other foundations, and third, a public policy analyst that can help advance public policy issues related to the district.
Have you had a good number of applicants?
We have had a limited number of applicants, but we have I think we had a few that are very qualified, and we're now in that process of interviewing them.
Oh, great.
Any more questions about the behavioral initiative? So we'll move on to grant payment schedule, Eastern Coachella Valley funding opportunity request. Is there any information on
So that's on page 5 of 5, it says?
4 to 5.
Mm-hmm. Page 5 of 5 in the board packet, right?
Overall,
page 4 and 5.
Okay, yes.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions about pages 4 and 5?
So the 3 pending funds, have they been approved by the board? Or did they come before us? Are they different?
No, I believe those are in the LOI stages, right?
Okay.
AGC is in stage 2 of the application. The application. Cal State, we are going to have a site visit with them. And Clinicus is also in the application phase. They're both looking for next month.
Conrado?
Yeah.
If and when we do get coronavirus requests from the East Valley, will we be able to comply?
I think so. And I don't see why we should restrict ourselves to limit the amount of funding that we allocate to providers that are located on the A site. That is a conversation we must have at the board when we bring a recommendation to make sure that we're not discriminating between East and West.
So last time you were at our board meeting, you said that the LAFCO director, I'm not sure what his title is, was concerned about, or so that I don't know how to say it.
Yeah.
Concerned about us like moving funds to the East Valley when
No, it was not moving about using funds on East Valley. His concern was about using funds to support things that other districts are responsible for, such as water, roads, you know.
You're right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
At least it's el miedo.
Is there any community committee member comments at this time?
I only have one old business type comment. We talked about the inability of the district to advertise, let the community nonprofits know about the availability of grant funds. Have we made any progress with that?
We're doing some advertisement about the district. I don't think that we can advertise about the funds. Most organizations know who we are and what we do, and I think that at this juncture in time, what we're looking is at doing some strategic directions for how we're going to address the public health crisis we have at our door. And we know that there are organizations that are working on funding requests that are coming to us that we have not been able to discuss with them because we are limited, but we know that they will be forthcoming.
I wonder what other districts are doing to let their community know.
So I think that it's a very good conversation. The board, I think, needs to have a broader conversation about how we're going to make those funds available and advertise how we're going to direct those funds. I believe that once we have the needs assessment and the health improvement plan, because I want to reiterate that the needs assessment is not just an exercise about identifying needs, but also about identifying solutions, and that the board should be making recommendations about how much funding will be allocated each year to addressing those solutions and inviting local organizations to have a more transparent and competitive process and with more guidance about how much funding should be available for different initiatives. One example of how we are doing funding is something that happened today at this meeting. We have the Find Food Bank that has received from the district $6 million over
the years, and they already know how they navigate this organization, how to put an LOI, how to complete a proposal, and they come with a request that, to me, it's exaggerated. We're funding 40% of a project that we probably shouldn't be funding. And then you have other organizations that are doing valuable work as well, and they're requesting only 50,000 or 75,000 or 100,000. And there is no guidance for us to say, what is the limit? What should we be funding? And I think that's a very valuable conversation we must have to bring equity in how we are supporting the nonprofit community and addressing the healthcare needs of Coachella Valley.
Sounds like a policy discussion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So at this moment, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you all for attending.
Thank you.